It's shiny and new. It's the Adventures of Indiana Jim, Episode 1, for March 9th, 2008.
And now, coming to you not exactly live from
the Cliffs of Insanity,
a man who needs no introduction, that international man of geekery, that intrepid arch-geekologist, Indiana Jim.
All right, so I'll be honest, what do you think? It's the beginning of a new era. It's the dawn of a new day. It's the start of a new thing that just oozes thinginess. And what do you think of the music, huh? Now, I spent so long trying to get somebody to give me something that just really evoked that spirit, you know, of adventure, excitement. A Jedi craves not these things. You know, there's the horrible Yoda, but you get the idea. Really, since this cold hit, I haven't been able to do a convincing Yoda at any particular time. So, anyway, I got a few things for you in this first episode. An essay. Woo! Haha, Sports Illustrated. No. An essay. Yes, essay. On why I don't play Dungeons & Dragons. And it may not be what you think it is, so I encourage you to stick around for that. A little bit more about global warming. Yeah, I know. It's still out there. The specter of Al Gore is still out there going, ooh, fear us, ourselves. Fear yourself. Yeah. Just a little something from a little guy who may or may not know something about science by the name of Michael Crichton. Yeah. That guy, you know, Dr. Michael Crichton, PhD in how many subjects? Like 3 or 4? The well-traveled and well-researched Michael Crichton. And let's see, as far as following things going on in the news, not really following all that much. You know, the writer's strike is over, hip hip frickin' ray. It still means Battlestar Galactica is delayed until October, and 24 until January of 09, which I guess I can forgive people for being ridiculous. And let's see, I linked you all on the blog to an article by a writer who isn't in Hollywood, who knows what's going on with the strike and had some pretty strong opinions about things that didn't jibe with the groupthink that was going on about that. And not really anything of interest going on out there, you know. It's pretty quiet in the realm of sci-fi-ness, except for, obviously, Gary Gygax, the co-founder, co-creator of Dungeons & Dragons, passing away recently, which prompted me to write this essay. And anyway, just a bunch of, you know, I don't really know what's going on out there. So why don't you tell me, huh? Yeah, at the end of this show, there's going to be a man to tell you how to contact me. But anyway, enough of that garbage. Play a promo. Why don't we play a promo? I think you're going to like this promo. It's a very important promo, a very special promo from a guy near and dear to my heart. So we'll get out of here and we'll get to that promo and we'll be back in a matter of moments, mere moments, kiddos.
Into your bloodstream like tiny little vampires. They hack into your nervous system like you were a walking computer network built just for them. They flood your body with chemicals that cause fear, paranoia, and psychotic rage. It's a disease that thinks. It's a disease that talks. And if you're lucky, you die before it becomes a disease that walks. On April Fool's Day, experience the horror thriller novel, Infected, the major hardcover release from number one bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of the free podcast novels, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Nocturnal. Available April 1st, online and in bookstores everywhere. Free audio chapters of Infected are available at scottsigler.com and infectednovel.com. The disease kills you slowly if the cure doesn't kill you first.
All right, and we're back. First thing we're going to tackle is this Michael Crichton business. And he recently gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, California. Okay, not recently. Never mind, I take it back. This is September 15th, 2003. So even before Al Gore won his freaking stupid Oscar for his gay movie. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Michael Crichton said that the greatest challenge facing mankind was distinguishing reality from fantasy and truth from propaganda. And he said, as an example of this challenge, I want to talk today about environmentalism. And in order not to be misunderstood, I want it perfectly clear that I believe it is incumbent on us to conduct our lives in a way that takes into account all the consequences of our actions, including the consequences to other people and the consequences to the environment. I believe it is important to act in ways that are sympathetic to the environment, and I believe this will always be a need carrying into the future. I believe the world has genuine problems, and I believe it can and should be improved. But I also think that deciding what constitutes responsible action is immensely difficult, and the consequences of our actions are often difficult to know in advance. I think our past record of environmental action is discouraging, to put it mildly, because even our best-intended efforts often go awry. But I think we do not recognize our past failures and face them squarely. And I think I know why. I studied anthropology in college, and one of the things I learned was that certain human social structures always reappear. They can't be eliminated from society. One of those structures is religion. Today, it is said we live in a secular society in which many people, the best people, the most enlightened people, do not believe in any religion. But I think that you cannot eliminate religion from the psyche of mankind. If you suppress it in one form, it merely reemerges in another. You can not believe in God, but you still have the... But you still have to believe in something that gives meaning to your life and shapes your sense of your world. Such a belief is religious. Today, one of the most powerful religions in the Western world is environmentalism. Environmentalism seems to be the religion of choice for urban atheists. Why do I say it's a religion? Well, just look at the beliefs. If you look carefully, you see that environmentalism is in fact a perfect 21st century remapping of traditional Judeo-Christian beliefs and myths. There's an initial Eden, a paradise, a state of grace and unity with nature. There's a fall from grace into a state of pollution as a result of eating from the tree of knowledge. And as a result of our actions, there is judgment day coming for us all. We are all energy sinners, doomed to die unless we seek salvation, which is now called sustainability. Sustainability is salvation in the church of the environment. Just as organic food is its communion, that pesticide-free wafer that the right people with the right beliefs imbibe. Eden, the fall of man, the loss of grace, the coming doomsday. These are deeply held mythic structures. They are profoundly conservative beliefs. They may even be hardwired into the brain, for all I know. I certainly don't want to talk anybody out of them, as I don't want to talk anybody out of a belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God who rose from the dead. But the reason I don't want to talk anybody out of these beliefs is that I know that I can't talk anybody out of them. These are not facts that can be argued. These are issues of faith. And so it is, sadly, with environmentalism. Increasingly, it seems facts aren't necessary because the tenets of environmentalism are all about belief. It's about whether you are going to be a sinner or saved, whether you are going to be one of the people on the side of salvation or on the side of doom, whether you are going to be one of us or one of them. Am I exaggerating to make a point? I'm afraid not, because we know a lot more about the world than we did 40 or 50 years ago, and what we know now is not so supportive of certain core environmental myths, yet the myths do not die. Let's examine some of those beliefs. There is no Eden. There never was. What was that Eden of the wonderful mythic past? Is it the time when infant mortality was 80%? When 4 children in 5 died of disease before the age of 5? When 1 woman in 6 died in childbirth? When the average lifespan was 40, as it was in America a century ago? When plagues swept across the planet, killing millions in a stroke, Was it when millions starved to death? Is that when it was Eden? And what about indigenous peoples living in a state of harmony with the Eden-like environment? Well, they never did. On this continent, the newly arrived people who crossed the land bridge almost immediately set about wiping out hundreds of species of large animals, and they did this several thousand years before the white man showed up, to accelerate the process. And what was the condition of life? Loving, peaceful, harmonious? Hardly. The early peoples of the New World lived in a state of constant warfare, generations of hatred, tribal hatreds, constant battles. The warlike tribes of this continent are famous, the Comanche, Sioux, Apache, Mohawk, Aztecs, Toltec, and Incas. Some of them practiced infanticide and human sacrifice. And those tribes that were not fiercely warlike were exterminated or learned to build their villages high in the cliffs to attain some measure of safety. How about the human condition in the rest of the world? The Maori of New Zealand committed massacres regularly. The Dayaks of Borneo were headhunters. The Polynesians, living in an environment as close to paradise as one can imagine, fought constantly and created a society so hideously restrictive that you could lose your life if you stepped in the footprint of a chief. It was the Polynesians who gave us the very concept of taboo, as well as the word itself. The noble savage is a fantasy, and it was never true. That anyone still believes it, 200 years after Rousseau, shows the tenacity of religious myths, their ability to hang on in the face of centuries of factual contradiction. There was even an academic movement during the latter 20th century that claimed that cannibalism was a white man's invention to demonize the indigenous peoples. Only academics could fight such a battle. It was some 30 years before professors finally agreed that yes, cannibalism does indeed occur among human beings. Meanwhile, all during this time, New Guinea Highlanders in the 20th century continued to eat the brains of their enemies until they were finally made to understand that they risked kuru, a fatal neurological disease, when they did so. Most recently still, the gentle Tassadai of the Philippines turned out to be a publicity stunt, a non-existent tribe, and African pygmies have one of the highest murder rates on the planet. In short, the romantic view of the natural world as a blissful Eden is only held by people who have no actual experience of nature. People who live in nature are not romantic about it at all. They may hold spiritual beliefs about the world around them. They may have a sense of the unity of nature or the aliveness of all things, but they still kill the animals and uproot the plants in order to eat to live. If they don't, they will die. Moving on, the truth is, almost nobody wants to experience real nature. What people want is to spend a week or two in a cabin in the woods with screens on the windows. They want a simplified life for a while without all their stuff, or a nice river rafting trip for a few days with somebody else doing the cooking. Nobody wants to go back to nature in any real way, and nobody does. It's all talk, and as the years go on and the world population grows increasingly urban, it's uninformed talk. Farmers know what they're talking about. City people don't. It's all fantasy. One way to measure the prevalence of fantasy is to note the number of people who die because they haven't the least knowledge of how nature really is. They stand beside wild animals like buffalo for a picture and get trampled to death. They climb a mountain in dicey weather without proper gear and freeze to death. They drown in the surf on holiday because they can't conceive the real power of what we blithely call the force of nature. They have seen the ocean, but they haven't been in it. The television generation expects nature to act the way they want it to be. They think all life experiences can be TiVo'd. The notion that the natural world obeys its own rules and doesn't give a damn about your expectations comes as a massive shock. Well-to-do, educated people in an urban environment experience the ability to fashion their daily lives as they wish. They buy clothes that suit their taste and decorate their apartments as they wish. Within limits, they can contrive a daily urban world that pleases them. But the natural world is not so malleable. On the contrary, it will demand that you adapt to it, and if you don't, you die. It is a harsh, powerful, and unforgiving world that most urban Westerners have never experienced. Well, he goes on with a lot of stuff. It's a pretty long little thing here. Let's see. Let's return to religion. If Eden is a fantasy that never existed, and mankind wasn't ever noble and kind and loving, if we didn't fall from grace, then what about the rest of the religious tenets? What about salvation, sustainability, and Judgment Day? What about the coming environmental doom from fossil fuels and global warming if we all don't get down on our knees and conserve every day? Well, it's interesting. You may have noticed that something has been left off the doomsday list lately. Although the preachers of environmentalism have been yelling about population for 50 years, over the last decade, world population seems to be taking an unexpected turn. Fertility rates are falling almost everywhere. As a result, over the course of my lifetime, the thoughtful predictions for total world population have gone from a high of 20 billion to 15 billion to 11 billion, which was the UN estimate around 1990, to now 9 billion and soon perhaps less. There are some who think that world population will peak in 2050 and start to decline. There are some who predict we will have fewer people in 2100 than we do today. Is this a reason to rejoice, to say hallelujah? Certainly not. Without a pause, we now hear about the coming crisis of world economy from a shrinking population. We hear about the impending crisis of an aging population. Nobody anywhere will say that the core fears expressed for most of my life have turned out not to be true. As we have moved into the future, these doomsday visions vanished like a mirage in the desert. They were never there, though they still appear in the future, as mirages do. Let's see. Nuts with placards. So I can tell you some facts. I know you haven't read any of what I am about to tell you in the newspaper because newspapers literally don't report them. I can tell you that DDT is not a carcinogen and did not cause birds to die and never should have been banned. I can tell you that the people who banned it knew that it wasn't carcinogenic and banned it anyway. I can tell you that the DDT ban has caused the deaths of tens of millions of poor people, mostly children, whose deaths are directly attributable to a callous, technologically advanced Western society that promoted the new cause of environmentalism by pushing a fantasy about a pesticide and thus irrevocably harmed the Third World. Banning DDT is one of the most disgraceful episodes in the 20th century history of America. We knew better and we did it anyway, and we let people around the world die and didn't give a damn. I can tell you that secondhand smoke is not a health hazard to anyone and never was, and the EPA has always known it. I can tell you that the evidence for global warming is far weaker than its proponents would ever admit. I can tell you the percentage of the U.S. land area that is taken by urbanization, including cities and roads, is 5%. I can tell you that the Sahara Desert is shrinking and the total ice of Antarctica is increasing. I can tell you that a blue ribbon panel in Science Magazine concluded that there is no known technology that will enable us to halt the rise of carbon dioxide in the 21st century. Not wind, not solar, not even nuclear. The panel concluded a totally new technology, like nuclear fusion, was necessary, otherwise nothing could be done, and in the meantime all efforts would be a waste of time. They said that when the UN IPCC report stated alternative technologies existed that could control greenhouse gases, the UN was wrong. I can, with a lot of time, give you the factual basis for these views, and I can cite through appropriate journal articles not in wacko magazines, but in the most prestigious science journals such as Science and Nature. But such references probably won't impact more than a handful of you, because the beliefs of a religion are not dependent on facts, but rather are matters of faith. Unshakable belief. And that's all I'm going to read from Michael Crichton. There's a lot of information in here. And again, this was a speech. Obviously, it's not an article with references and all that stuff. Giving a address would be quite boring if he were to start spouting research, but I can tell you that there's plenty of research out there if you go and look for it. And this is the thing, we all take what the media gives us, and this is the thing that we all love about the internet, is that you can go and find both sides of any issue. And I think that's what I love most about this generation, is that we're not stupid, we're not afraid of the internet, and the internet is a wonderful place to find as much as you want to put in your head. And I would just encourage anyone to look at both sides of any issue, especially one that threatens to change the lives of people on Earth, whether for the good or the bad. Whether good idea or bad idea, it portends a lot of change for a lot of people. But anyway, that's Michael Crichton, his words on environmentalism and global warming. And that's about it for this segment. So what we're going to do is we're going to come back with a little something I like to call an essay on why I don't play Dungeons and Dragons. And it might not be the answer you think.
Years into the future, mankind has conquered the solar system. Humanity has entered a new era of peace and exploration. But a looming threat could spell the end of everything. The fate of civilization rests in the hands of an unlikely hero.
Excuse me, hero? You know, I've been called a lot of things over the years. Criminal, con artist, traitorous bitch. But hero? Well, yes, but they were being sarcastic. This is the story of how I saved the universe.
Space Casey is an audio drama miniseries from Christiana Ellis. Subscribe now at www.spacecasey.com.
You'll love it. Trust me.
Now, the reason I played that promo, Space Casey obviously has finished its run. But if you have not heard Space Casey, get over to www.spacecasey.com and check it out. It's very entertaining, very funny, and very well produced. And now we come to something that I've really been looking forward to bringing you. In fact, more than that silly speech from Michael Crichton. This is why I don't play Dungeons & Dragons. Recently, Gary Gygax, co-creator of the famous and infamous role-playing game, passed away at the age of 69. Well, this prompted my brain to churning as I read various tributes to the man. Part of me wanted to jump into a game right away because the geek genes wanted to immediately pay tribute to the man. The second thought I had was, why waste my time? It's not as though I have anything against Dungeons & Dragons, I don't. In fact, the second most memorable summer in my life occurred in Modesto, California, staying with my grandparents at the age of 10 and playing the game with two cousins of mine and their friend. We not only played Dungeons & Dragons, he called it Middle Earth and assured me it wasn't the same as D&D, I later learned the obvious truth of the matter, but we also created role-playing games, new lines for G.I. Joe action figures, and just had a whale of a time that summer. Our G.I. Joe role-playing game was something of which I was insanely proud, and my grandmother's yard was the landscape upon which G.I. Joe and Cobra waged war. I could say I don't play Dungeons & Dragons for many reasons, first among them the religious ones. Obviously, the modern Christian church at large has learned to wage political and psychological warfare when concerned with the spiritual one. The loudest hue and cry is that of witchcraft. Spells are cast in this game. Oh, noes! I've heard it said that the game's creators studied witchcraft, as in Wiccan philosophies or some such thing, for a flavor of authenticity. But let's also remember that many Christians also rail against the evils of Tolkien for his use of certain magic in his stories, not to mention Miss Rowling and the cheesy parlor trick Latin that couldn't conjure up a puff of smoke. Expelliarmus! Run for the hills! People can be evil, or worse, chaotic evil. Any game, after all, that encourages children to act without complete moral fiber cannot be good whatsoever. Let's not forget that the use of trolls and orcs and demons and demons is anything, in anything, is just right out. However, from a truly biblical and Christian perspective, Satan is said to appear as an angel of light, seeming to be good and right while stabbing you in the back with a knife. Satan never comes up and says, "Boo, I'm evil, run away, ha ha ha." So, to set yourself down behind a game board with dice and characters whose motivations may or may not be of a noble and upright nature, and do battle against the minions of hell and whatnot, is apparently to enter into the realm of spiritual warfare, where real demonic activity takes place because, after all, it has really frightening pictures and, gosh, isn't magic bad. My wife had a cousin who was one of the infamous D&D suicides. This is maybe the most legitimate concern of people who fear horror stories about the game because, after all, who would want their kids to wind up like that? But ignorant parents listen to the tales of other ignorant parents and ignorant media and have a knee-jerk reaction to anything that looks frightening or beyond understanding. From a clear numbers standpoint, more teenagers die from drunk driving accidents. In fact, I think more young people have died from school violence at this point than could ever result from playing Dungeons & Dragons. The fact is that Dungeons & Dragons is even at the bottom of the list of causes for suicide. Like many geek obsessions, it can almost appear like a cult thing. From Star Trek fans to Star Wars fans to Firefly fans to the freaks who wear black trench coats and sunglasses. Kidding, Matrix fans. We really do look, well, freakish. We go to conventions for something that doesn't get us ahead in any particular material arena. It's the reason we're outcasts. We're nerds, dorks, geeks, whatever. But like I've said on my podcast promo before, this is where we look for understanding in our world. Myths help us get outside the daily rigmarole, but this is beside the point. When outcasts fail to receive understanding from those they value socially, they turn to that social network that supports them. When parents are distant and refuse to learn about their kids, the kids turn to something or someone else that gives them significance. Since we geeks like to dress in costumes, it's not too strange when we think of the game groups that do the same thing. Inevitably, someone takes the thing too far and someone gets hurt. Have you seen the movie Jackass? Those are some dumb people who just can't even claim that a role-playing game made them do it. That's just plain old stupidity, and yes, it happens even to people who play D&D. The reason young people commit suicide can usually be boiled down to loneliness. Look, no one can deny the power of parents to motivate their children and point them on the road to well-being or the road to destruction. Parental involvement, or the level thereof, is a basic social need, and sometimes a kid has an imagination that works differently than their parents. Plus, the need to find social interaction results in kids finding like-minded kids to spend time with. Outcasts will inevitably find each other. It's parents that keep kids going, giving them the ultimate significance they need. When a kid feels rejected by their parents for the same reason, true or not, that they are rejected at school, that will destroy a kid's confidence and sense of self-worth. Granted, many parents who face the tragedy of child suicide believe they are as involved and supportive as they can be, and perhaps they are. I take nothing away from them, and my heart breaks for them as a fellow parent. But sometimes we really just don't know the reason behind a suicide. The cult appearance can happen anywhere, for any reason. Like any pastime, we can take it too far. Recently, two Hispanic brothers fought over Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and one of them was either killed or seriously injured. I can't really remember. People fight over sports teams or Macs versus PCs. Grown adults get too engrossed in their work and neglect their families. Hobbies of all kinds become time sinks and almost cultish. From role-playing games to video games to fishing to working on cars to being in a gang on the streets, we all look for something to give us significance or release stress. How much time and emotional attachment we put into those things is the key. My 5-year-old son loves to watch movies with swordplay, and it's clear he takes after me in that regard. But he's also far more aggressive than I was as a kid, so he responds differently. I need to manage how much time he puts into watching movies. He's also been affected by my playing SOCOM, despite the absence of blood and its almost cartoonish nature, and I've drastically removed him from ever watching that sort of thing. People become addicted, and it can happen with D&D. So what am I getting at with all this? I don't play Dungeons & Dragons for the simple reason that I love playing Dungeons & Dragons. Role-playing games like that put me into the pseudo-medieval mythical fantasy setting I love. Plus, I get to use swords! 12D broadsword, baby! I don't play it because I know I have to, number one, find a group. That's not too hard because Mick Bradley is just across the river and I know he's got a group. Number two, find a night on my schedule to play. This is very difficult. Number three, convince my wife to let me out of the house to go over to a stranger's house to play the game that, quote, killed your cousin. Yeah, not happening. Four, find a night on my schedule. Did I already say that? Right. I understand that to be involved takes involvement that I just don't have time for, and I know I'm going to become geekly obsessed over it. The best reason for me not to play is because I want all the power. Why invest myself in a plot, setting, and characters that may be rather entertaining but ultimately only serve as amusement? Instead, I can make up my own plot, create my own setting, make characters that entertain me completely, and obey only my commands. Then everyone who reads it will be pulled along where I want them to go. The best part about it is, if I'm any good, someone will actually pay me to do it. So not only does it give me ultimate power as DM and game participant, it could also give me money. Time spent on D&D could be time spent on writing. Writing could potentially make for a very nice career and could enable me to pursue other creative ventures and ultimately prove better for my family and give me more time to be involved with my kids. Have a nice game, guys. Wish I could be there with you. Just, you know, remember to buy my books, will ya? And believe it or not, that's pretty much all I have.
You have chosen wisely.
Yes, people like a peppy episode. One that moves briskly through everything. And really, I thought the Michael Crichton thing would take longer. I'm glad it didn't. I'm glad I kind of breezed through it. Because I know, you know, it's something that... You know, nobody likes to talk about religion, right? Okay. So, anyway. That's it for tonight. And, you know, I'm glad you guys are there. I want to thank everybody for tuning back in, sticking with the feed, sticking with me, wondering when my episodes were going to come out, and I just thank you very much, and I hope this is the beginning of a long tenure with the Adventures of Indiana Jim. So thank you very much, and I'll see you in the next episode.
You've been listening to The Adventures of Indiana Jim, a production of Visionary Creative Works. Visit podcast.indianajim.net and leave comments on the blog. Send in your emails and audio feedback to podcast@indianajim.net. I'm Dr. John Small. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Now, Jazla gets you to the new frontiers of radio automation.
The new frontiers of radio automation.
Bring your station into the new age of music and let Jazla do the rest. Jazla, the leading radio automation software.
Software. Software. Software. Software.